I'm talking to Maceo Montoya.
That's right.
Again, we've had you on for many books, and this is the latest book we're going to talk about today, Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces. And so now I have you, and I was thinking, well, don't try to always relate Maceo with his family. How do you feel about when people always say, hey, aren't you the son of Maceo Montoya or the brother of Andres Montoya?
Yeah, I've never had an issue with it. I've always just felt, you know, just really proud and lucky to be from the family that I'm part of. And, you know, my creative gifts, come from them and their influence. And I never saw it as a burden. I've always seen it as as only a blessing. And, my dad, I think some point in my mid 20s, because he was very hard on me growing up, and hard on me kind of from a pedagogical standpoint,
right?
Like the lessons and the discipline and very guided me very, very clearly. And then at some point in my mid 20s, he let go. And I don't know if that was because of where he was at in life, because I never got the sense that he let go with my elder brothers, right? He was still very hard on them. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm because I'm the youngest, but whatever it was, he just kind of trusted me to go in my own direction. And so I was able to, kind of carry that legacy forward, but pursue my own path and not feel like it was being judged or questioned in any way.
It sounds like it was a good choice on his part, because here you are, and you've been a professor now at our one institution, UC Davis. You are an associate professor. Now you're going up for full professor. You have at least 6 books of fiction that I know of. Well, actually, one's nonfiction, which is what is it? Beginner's Guide to Chicano Literature.
Yeah, the Chicano Movement for Beginners. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I got a copy of it. I picked up a copy of it, and I love what you're doing there. But yeah, you've accomplished quite a bit at 40 years old. There's not very many full professors at 40 years old. And one of the first things I wanted to ask you about, from my perspective, you come out with a book a year. Maybe it isn't quite that. Maybe it is. But from my perspective, I just want to know about your, not so much your work ethic, but your work habits. What is a typical work day like for you?
Well, you know, it hasn't been a book a year. It's been, it had been almost 5 years since Chicano Movement for Beginners came out, and then publishing Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces. In between, I had 2 collaborations where I contributed bodies of artwork, one with David Campos, the other for a translation of the Mexican poet Mario Santiago Papasquiaro. So those came in between. I feel like I'm always working on a project, and even if it doesn't have much success, or I send it out and I get a whole bunch of rejections, I continue working on it at the same time that I'm working on other projects. And so I think that I've gotten pretty good at juggling works, and moving in between, different mediums. I think that definitely helps, whether I'm working on a novel or I've attempted kind of these screenplays and the small film projects, or working in the studio. And so I think each of these different creative outlets gives me enough of a breather so that when I return to the novel, I don't feel like I've, I have to kind of like start from scratch. I'm kind of constantly, moving between these projects, and the creative juices are flowing. And when I'm working in the studio, it can kind of give me a different perspective when I return to my desk and I'm working on a novel. But I would say that the best habit I have, and that's when I'm working on a novel, is that I set up a word count, and whether it's 1,000 words or 1,500 words or 2,000, and I stick to it. And so I've gotten pretty confident over the years that a first draft of a novel will take me 3 to 4 months to write. And I know how important it is to finish it. And so I don't set it aside. You know, it's just like during those periods, it's very intense. And I get that first draft finished. And then there's a long gestation period. I'll let it sit for a while. I'll send it to the few readers that I have and that I trust. I get their feedback. I work on it some more. Preparatory notes for future masterpieces was in that kind of that process for almost 10 years. And in the meantime, I worked on other novels, worked on other projects, and kept on returning to preparatory notes. And that kind of influenced the development and the evolution of the book so that it became what it needed to be, which would have been very different if I had finished it, you know, after that first draft and, you know, did a second and third and fourth draft. And then, you know, maybe it was ready at that point, you know, 8 or 9 years ago. It needed that long period of gestation to become what it is with all of its different elements.
You know, I have a friend, you know, Benjamin Sines. We mentioned him earlier before we started the show, how he started off as a co-host. And Benjamin is writing these incredibly successful YA novels. And his process is he'll spend all day, if he has to, writing a perfect paragraph. A couple of days writing a perfect paragraph, but he doesn't go back. And so by the time he's done with the first draft, which may take him 2-3 years, it's perfect.
Oh, that's amazing. That's
I can't
amazing.
Do that. I can't do that. I do what you do. I can get a draft of a book out in 3 or 4 months. But as excited as I am about it, I don't have the other outlets that you do. And I'm starting to develop them. I guess I do, actually, if I rethink and say, yeah, this show is one of those other outlets. I can concentrate on the show. I can concentrate on, I'm recently stepping down as department chair for the creative writing department here at the University of Texas. I could, I could say that those are my projects, but yeah, one draft and then 2 or 3 years revision.
Yeah.
But I really think that's a healthy thing to go from, you're a visual artist, you're an activist, you're a professor, and to have all these other different projects.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing that Benjamin can do that, right? What I find difficult to do, and, you know, the novel, I feel, is like, one of the reasons why it attracts me is because it's this imperfect form, right? It's just, it's so long, it's unwieldy. There's so many different, variations, and it's a puzzle piece, and you're always trying to like move these puzzle pieces around to finally kind of get to something that resembles a finished product. Right. It still never feels finished, right? There's kind of these infinite amount of variations. And so there was a time, right, where I would just agonize over every sentence. And then, you know, several drafts later, remove that whole section.
Right.
And so I think I've learned to be kind of less precious. Again, because I know the words can come, right? Or so far they always have, right? It's also very easy to kind of remove them. And, you know, I think about the tens of thousands of words that have been cut from my novels that are just there. And yet, you know, again, it's just part of my process is the willingness to edit and remove.
Right. You know, and as you get older, you're a whopping 40 years old. And, you know, as you get older and as you're committed to your art, you're committed to your craft, because, I mean, it's not just enough to be committed to the art. You have to be committed to the craft, the technique, and to learn it and to teach it. And what ends up happening is what we might have taken years and years to discover on a first draft when we first started. Now, because we have been studying craft, it just kind of comes together more organically, more quickly. Do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, I guess even through a first draft or second, I'm aware of the changes that are going to be made or that I'm going to have to make. And so I'm kind of several steps ahead, Right. Uh-huh. Whereas I think before, when I was first starting, it was, I was just like, I was completely immersed and kind of lost in that first draft. Whereas now it's, let me get the words out. Let me get the story out, but I'm already starting to think about those subsequent drafts as being part of my process. And so almost a kind of thing, well, I'll handle it then, or I'll deal with this part then, taking notes as I go along, preparing me for the later drafts. Yeah. And I also found that when you talk about craft, and I think it can be a difficult thing to kind of describe, like, what is that, right? What is craft? How do you learn it? And, I found that just from the many novels that I've worked on, most of my novels have not found their way into print, right? They're just kind of files.
Oh, really? Computer.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I mean, I've read one novel that you wrote, sent me a copy of that I've never, still has yet to see the light of day.
Yeah,
I didn't know you had a graveyard of novels.
Definitely a graveyard, and works that I'll return to, and I'm glad they're in their graveyard, right? I learned from them, right? And that was why they were worthwhile for sure. But the writing wasn't there yet, or the story wasn't quite right. But I guess I just found like everything slowed down. I found that when I'm reading a novel, it kind of slows down and I can see all the pieces, and the same thing when I'm writing one. And that's like that's a special place to be, I feel like. That comes just with time and having all that experience under your belt.
Yeah, I like that. I like you say everything slows down, because one of the metaphors that I try to sometimes explain to my students, mostly undergraduates who, especially talented undergraduates who resist craft. Mm-hmm. Andres was that way. Andres Montoya was that way. He resisted craft when he was in creative writing programs and departments. And he called it, cracker craft. I don't want to learn that stuff. I'm a Chicano. I don't need to learn that crap. But, what I tell my students that resist it, I say, well, craft is like when you study Kung Fu, a very formal, ancient approach to Kung Fu. What you spend a lot of time doing in the studio is forms. Every day these forms where you take your arm and you move it there, you move this arm there, you go like this. And it's just so hard. And it's so boring, because all you want to do is fight. Mm-hmm. That's all you want to do. You want to learn how to fight. That's why you're there. And this seems ridiculous. But the more you have that embedded into your code, embedded into your muscle memory, the more likely when you're walking down the street and it's dark and then there's an actual threat, that you're just going to get into that form naturally without having to think about it. And it's the same with craft. When you're writing that draft, you are following language. You are just, you are just going with it. And all that form, all that technique, all those things that you learned just become part of the flow, just a natural, it's embedded in you. It's in your muscle, your intellectual muscle memory.
No, absolutely. But, and that being said, I'm still kind of not surprised, but it can often be demoralizing, I'm still capable of writing a very bad novel where I've like missed, there's so many blind spots. Right. And, you send it out to readers and they point out all those blind spots, and there can be this frustration. Like, why didn't I see that? Right. Like this is my, 10th attempt at a novel. Why is it like I'm just beginning? And I feel like that's part of the process and excitement of following the language is each new novel is a completely new puzzle, right? That yes, you have more tools to work with, right? You have more experience that you're drawing upon, but it's still a new puzzle that needs to be figured out. And it doesn't come, it doesn't come automatically.
Right.
At least when you're, when you're challenging yourself, right? I'm sure there's writers who...
But also you're 40 years old. And, I'm teasing you about that being old, but I'm 58. Next month, I'm going to be 59, which is going to be the very last year of my 50s. Mm. And it's a crazy experience. When you arrive here, you'll see how crazy it is, because you could be walking downtown past a bank and looking into those glass windows, and you see an old man, and it takes you a nanosecond to realize that it's you. Because you still carry you inside of you. That doesn't change, right? But it's an incredible experience. So I think by the time you're 59, you're going to have learned and taught craft and been exposed to many, many, many more patterns and rhythms of fiction writing and of novels. And you're going to have been exposed to, you know, so many different other things that when you're doing the writing process, there's going to be less of that error space. I would imagine that by the time you're in your 50s and you're writing a novel, it's probably going to turn out okay. It's all a development. We're all still developing, you know, and once you stop developing, that's when you become a parody of yourself.
Yeah.
Which you don't do. Scoundrel and the Optimist, your first novel. It was a good novel. It was funny. And it had a lot of elements that still exist in the work today, specifically this preparatory notes for future masterpieces, one of those being incredible humor, and the other one being very insecure characters, and another one being a parallel or relationship or even an honoring of Latin American fiction. Fiction that comes from Argentina and Mexico and from all over Latin America. You have a very Latin American type of, but you went to a new level with You Must Fight Them. You Must Fight Them, I think, is where I just see your character leading, in ways that maybe they weren't able to lead in the first novel. Mm-hmm. And your character, I compare that to Philip Roth, his first collections and his first novels. I mean, it's very, very depth of character. And this one, you keep going to another level. This is one of the most easy novels for me to read in years. And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean that I didn't have to force myself to go back and finish it. It's so enjoyable and it's so easy to read and it's so pleasurable. Was there something different in the process of this one and They Must Fight You that didn't exist in Scoundrel and the Optimist and maybe even Whopper Barraza?
Yeah, you know, so I felt like Scoundrel and the Optimist was my fourth attempt at a novel, the first to be published. But the previous novel that I had written was like The Inheritance of Socrato Mérida, and it was based on my hometown. And Socrato Mérida was kind of a stand-in for me. And it was all over the place. And I mean, there's probably 800,000 words about that novel and half of them are gone, right? But it was because it was so all over the place. And I knew that I had lost track of where I was. The Scoundrel and the Optimist was written kind of in response. And I set up like a very specific discipline approach to that novel. It's like every chapter was going to be 1,000 words, and it was going to be every day I wrote those 1,000 words, and it progressed in that way. So it was very controlled. Uh-huh. And I also knew where it was going to end. And so it was an exercise, and it was an exercise that I think succeeded, but it was definitely framed by that exercise. The deportation of Whopper Barraza was another. I had read Roberto Bolaño's The Savage Detectives, and I loved how it was told through these multiple voices. And it was like, I want to tell a story in that way. And it became its own thing, but it began as an exercise. Like I saw something and I wanted to attempt it. Whereas with preparatory notes for future masterpieces, I feel like I started to tell that story and it was like, it was so organic to who I was and the voice that was emerging that I almost wasn't ready yet. I was like, no, I'm not ready for that novel. And so I wrote a couple of chapters and then set it aside because I was so excited. But that feeling of like, is it time? Is it time for that novel? And when I returned to it, I found that the voice kind of reemerged, right? That was my voice. That was the way that I wanted to tell a story. And so you're right. the very insecure narrator, the use of humor, the absurdity, but it just felt like I was, you know, less talking and more singing as I found my way through. And I remember reading that Sal Bello felt that way when he wrote The Adventures of Augie March, where his first two novels were these, you know, did well and were, you know, finely written. But it wasn't until The Adventures of Augie March, where it was like, I'm an American, you know, Chicago, born and raised, something like that. And then it just took off from there. And that was how I felt with Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces. There was a lot that was edited out, including those first chapters that I had thought was like an intro. Those were removed. And so the voice, of course, that was so excited about had to be distilled. It did have to be reined in. But the feeling of being in control was always there.
Right. You know, and what's really, I think ever since, We Must Fight Them. And then also in this book, what's just really there is the entire story is filtered through the character's desire, through the character's yearning, through what it is that, you know, that you know, which is what matters in character-based fiction, right? And so I imagine following that character's yearning, that character's perspective, that character's voice, and having the experience of, you know, learning craft and reading Sal Bello and, you know, and all this it's not only made this your best novel yet, I think it's an amazing novel. But it also, it shows your development, and we don't know where it's going to go yet. We don't know what Maceo is going to be writing in 10 years, but it's exciting to see where, you know, what direction it's going. Do you know where Maceo's novels are going to be in 10 years?
No, I don't. Yeah, again, I guess it goes back to like every new novel is like a new project, right? And so I'm not like thinking, oh, Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces was this, right? Experimental with the use of footnotes and this commentary on the Latinx and Chicanx canon. The illustrations that kind of weave throughout the book. Do I now need, is that going to be my thing? I don't feel that pressure. I feel like I've written other novels. I have two drafts that I'm working on, and they feel very different. One of them, you know, I almost felt at times was humorless and just like a drag to write. But it's a good story, and it's a story that I want to tell, and I feel challenged by it. And so I have to follow that. Even though I don't think that at any point I felt like it was singing in the same way that those first drafts of Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces was. And, you know, I think many writers are, but hyper aware of the traditions in which I'm working, the writers who I admire and want to attempt, right? I want to attempt to write a book like that. Mm-hmm. And that's where Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces kind of emerged from. I've always loved these books that kind of tackle history, and their characters are at the center of this history, and that involve humor. So Gunther Grass's Tin Drum had a huge influence on me. Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children. I've always loved a book that had a huge impact on me was Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. And so Preparatory Notes for Future Masterpieces was my attempt to kind of do a Chicano version of these historical novels. But as you pointed out, right, it's filtered through the lens of this character, the narrator. And as much as I wanted him to engage with Chicano history, all he was focused on was his preparatory notes to, you know, create the artistic masterpieces that he thought was his destiny. And so, yes, he runs into Reyes López Tijerina, the Chicano movement land rights leader, to runs into Oscar Zera Costa. But you know, it's almost,
and he kills him, doesn't he?
And he kills him, right? He's that the mystery is solved. He's the one who killed Oscar Zeta Costa.
That was great. Yeah.
But you know, he wanted to do his own thing. He was focused on himself and his development and his process, you know, almost to a selfish extent. And I had to follow that. I had to honor what my character, the direction that he was taking. Right.
Can you just summarize the book for us? Just talk a little bit about, you know, the character and the story and, Yeah, there's some allusion in the text that it's a Bildungsroman, which it very much, you know, in many ways is. But talk a little bit about the story.
Yeah. So the narrator is a young Mexican American growing up in like in remote mountains of New Mexico, and his father owns property, and it kind of creates this like distance between him and everyone else, right? He has this sense of entitlement and privilege, and these different markers in his life have allowed him to believe that he's more than just this kid from the backwoods of New Mexico. He has this great desire to be an artist. And he comes across this book in the library that he steals about the great painters, the great French painters. And so he's very much attracted to Gustave Courbet, who was also a landowner's son. And so he has this dream of becoming an artist and going to Paris. And yet over and over, he's reminded that he's just this Mexican-American kid from New Mexico, and he couldn't be further from his dream of becoming an artist and making his way to Paris. His one attempt to escape New Mexico was he and his friend Enrique make their way to Los Angeles. He suffers from epileptic fits, and it's kind of hinted that he's the one who started the Zoot Suit riots that happened in 1943. And so after that, he returns to New Mexico, and it's just about over and over his thwarted attempts to become an artist. And, you know, the first drafts where the illustrations weren't included, you could almost forget that he was Mexican-American. He talked about it so little. He didn't have a racialized sense of himself, other than that he was kind of better than others, right? He wanted to distance himself because they didn't see the world in his way. But it was important for me to include those illustrations because I was drawing a Mexican-American kid, right? Or Mexican-American guy as he's moving through this world. And so I didn't want to let the reader forget that what were the chances of a Mexican-American becoming an artist in the 1940s and 1950s? And it's a question that I thought about a lot with my family, right? How my uncle Jose Montoya, my dad Malaquias, how from migrant farm workers did they make it to becoming, you know, at the vanguard of the Chicano movement and the Chicano art renaissance? It was the movement. It was the Chicano movement that kind of formed them as artists and where they found their voice. My narrator never really quite finds that. He never finds a community. He always kind of resists any attempts or any any instance in which, you know, to form these kind of bonds, he goes in the opposite direction because he's so singular, right? And it's something that I've thought about often within the context of Chicano literature, is it's often told within a community or a family. But what about the outsiders and those that don't fit? And that's definitely my narrator. He's in a way outside of history as much as he's a part of history. And I wanted to explore that story and its implications.